normally easy for people to communicate, but sending a postcard from this floating post office gives one a really different feeling.
The floating post office underwent reconstruction in 2011 and is currently a part of the Indian postal system. Recently, the office started offering banking services, thus attracting more locals.
I have opened an account here for my daughter. It's hassle-free and this place suits my mind. It's not like the usual offices. Visiting this place with kids is like a trip.
Yet another attraction of this post office is this souvenir shop, from where everyone can buy postcards, stamps, traditional crafts and greeting cards.
This floating post office in Kashmir's Dal Lake is like a time machine. It brings people back to 2 centuries ago and shows them the history of the beautiful region. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the public sphere, aerial photography and satellite images are censored by the US government, thus Google, Facebook et al., creating a situation where Palestinians are alienated from their own cartography. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jim Miles Ryder. This article is published under the heading Between a Rising Tide and Apartheid, Environmental Justice in Palestine. Stay tuned for more. A recent seminar from the group Visualizing Palestine served to present 4 graphic representations of environmental problems within Palestine. The graphics are self-explanatory and need no review here. They are after all graphic and speak well for themselves. The discussion talked around the graphics, what they emphasize, and how they are necessary for a clear understanding of environmental issues in Palestine. The overriding message of the environmental perspective of the discussion is that it cannot be separated from the colonial settler geopolitical message. Colonial settler actions are destructive and extractive for indigenous environments, whether in Palestine or in other areas of European Western conquest. While not described as such, the presentation very well fits under the academic rubric of cultural geography, the effects of culture on geography and its corollary, how changes to geographical situations are used to create a dominant culture. One of the recurring issues was presenting maps, a graphic that can reveal much about colonial destruction, settler extraction, and attempts to greenwash settler actions. In the public sphere, aerial photography and satellite images are censored by the US government. Thus, Google, Facebook et al., creating a situation where Palestinians are alienated from their own cartography. This has two main components. First, after the Nakba and the destruction of over 500 villages and towns, the Israelis researched all Arab place names to be replaced with Hebraized or biblical names. Most of the villages destroyed were completely demolished, completely erased through manipulations of the map. Further, more than 180 were concealed by parks and reserves using non-native species planted on the land to conceal its original occupation. The fake regime of Israel has used this in a form of greenwashing, able to boast about the many trees it has planted and the forests and parks it has created, all the while eliminating any trace of indigenous land. Most people probably do not see this as an environmental issue per se, but the environment cannot be separated from earlier the geography or the culture of a place. The land is the people. These spatial representations make the visualizing of Palestine objective and factual. The one graphic map on hazardous waste sites fully demonstrates the toxic occupation of Palestinian lands. The most compelling statement made during the discussion on cartography was the settler colonial imperative is to create private land for profit, a strong summation. Climate change and environmental damage affect women and youth severely. Childhood diseases due to malnutrition and poor water quality, particularly mentioned in Gaza, affects women as caregivers. Recent heat waves, the loss of electricity, and the density of refugee settlements have exacerbated women's access to healthcare facilities and information. Women working in agriculture are not considered in studies and research. After displacement due to flooding, women do double the work and most of the family recovery. All this, heat, floods, poor agricultural compensation, all have the most impact on women and thus the families they support. The discussion on youth and environment centered on the question of why or why not Palestinian young people would participate in the climate strike actions as seen in many other countries. It comes down to the question of, will I be alive tomorrow? What is more important, my surviving for another day or protesting climate issues? The latter would induce a reaction from the Zionist regime interest in the form of military action or settler action to protest the violence of the youth protest. As for recycling, systems and geographies created under occupation do not allow for an interest in recycling efforts. Gaza carried much of the discussion as it is an imprisonment enclave entirely controlled by the Zionist regime. It suffers from issues as indicated, from heat and flooding, but derived in part from this food insecurity. In addition, 25% of good agricultural land is in the buffer zone declared by the Zionist regime, a de facto free fire zone for the IDF. The Zionist regime controls food imports and exports by way of the Gaza blockade. Military and foreign aid pressure is used to deliberately increase the cultural destruction of Palestine. The deliberate destruction of the emblematic olive trees is an attack on both food security and cultural identity. The 15-year blockade of Gaza has weakened and jeopardized Gaza's infrastructure, in particular with water, wastewater, and general pollution. The Zionist regime water diversion and co-option of Palestinian agriculture, that is, strawberries in northern Gaza, marketed as production seriously affects the food security of the population, now at 68% of the population, and only going to increase as the adaptive capacity of Gaza is already exhausted. They are economically and socially and culturally much more vulnerable to damages. The field of cultural geography covers the various topics raised in the discussion of the environment and its impacts on Palestine. Ironically, from the title, apartheid was not discussed per se, but is evident through the discussions of parks, forests, erased villages, hazardous toxic waste sites, and Gaza, and is visible on the cartographic expression of the geography. The graphic information presented by visualizing Palestine is clear, immediate, and easy to understand. It is an important addition to the overall struggle for freedom from colonial settlerism, ethnic cleansing, and the apartheid nature of the system it creates.
A new front has opened in the war on Yemen. Yemen's National Salvation Government, using missiles and drones, carried out a successful strike all the way in Abu Dhabi, the capital of the United Arab Emirates. As you know, the UAE is part of the Saudi-led coalition that's been committing genocide in Yemen for 7 years in an attempt to overthrow the Popular Salvation Government, also known as the Houthis or Ansar Allah. In 2019, the Emirates withdrew some of its troops from Yemen, appearing to decrease its involvement in the war. But the UAE is still very much involved. It's been working hand in glove with Saudi Arabia, butchering the people of Yemen. And all the while, their beloved capital, Abu Dhabi, prides itself in being a safe, fashionable, and rich destination to work, live, and travel for foreigners and expats. But now, the game has changed, because this is the first time that the war has really come to the UAE's doorstep. So why is this strike so significant? What does it say about Yemen's military capabilities? Is it just a one-off success for the Salvation Government, or a real game changer? Saudi Arabia's allies, like the United States, were very quick to condemn the attack. So how come they said nothing when Saudi Arabia subsequently launched a wave of airstrikes on Yemen, killing hundreds and even knocking out public infrastructure? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Since 2015, Yemen has been under constant attack from Saudi Arabia and its coalition. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed as a result, the vast majority of them civilians. This war has been openly and brazenly supported by the West. The United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany, Canada have all profited greatly from killing Yemenis, selling boatloads of weapons to Saudi Arabia and its allies. The US and UK, in particular, have played a considerable role, providing intelligence, logistical support, refueling, and much more to the Saudi-led coalition. This has resulted in Yemenis being killed either by conventional armaments or from malnourishment, disease, and other ailments brought on by Saudi Arabia's destruction of Yemeni public infrastructure and the blockade of Yemen, which has been in place since 2015. Things are so bad that the United Nations has described the situation in Yemen as the world's largest humanitarian crisis, with 21 million Yemenis in need of humanitarian assistance. And while the Saudi-led coalition has enjoyed high-tech military equipment and logistical support and intelligence from the Americans, the Yemeni National Salvation Government has turned the war into a quagmire for them. In the beginning, the Saudis thought they could easily overrun Yemen and put the overthrown president, Abdurrabba Mansour Hadi, back in power. But the Saudis miscalculated. And not only they miscalculated, but so did the Emiratis, who've helped them attack Yemen. They thought the conflict would stay far away from their borders and be confined just to Yemen. But that has changed. On January 17th, 2022, the Yemen Salvation Government struck Abu Dhabi, the UAE's capital. Using a combination of drones and missiles, two different targets were hit. The first, an oil facility in Musafa, and the second, a construction site at Abu Dhabi's international airport. Both places were set ablaze by the attack. Despite pulling back its troops, the UAE is still in the war and has been using its so-called Giants Brigade to push Yemen's National Salvation Government out of strategic locations like Shebwa and the oil-rich province of Ma'rib. Now, considering the technological and military upper hand that the Saudi coalition has enjoyed, due largely to all the equipment provided by the US and co., it's frankly quite remarkable that the Yemenis were able to strike so far away and so deep within Emirati territory. Not many people expected that, least of all the Emiratis. This attack must have really caught them off guard and angered them, because what ensued were the deadliest attacks on the Yemeni capital of Sana'a since 2019. The Saudi-led coalition spent several days pounding the capital and other cities, killing scores of civilians. On January 18th, 2022, the Saudi-led coalition killed 20 people when it bombed Sana'a. 2 days later, on January 20th, a football stadium in Hodeidah Governorate was struck as a kids' football team was playing. 4 children were killed and 13 wounded. The latest and deadliest attack came on January 21st, when Saudi planes bombed a detention center in Sa'da, killing at least 70 people. Inmates, the bulk of the victims, could be seen desperately trying to get out from under the rubble. And later the same day, there was another strike on the port city of Hodeidah, which took out a telecommunications center critical to Yemen's internet. As a result, Yemen's entire internet connection was taken offline. A second guest who was set to join us here on the program was unable to make it as a result. Now, bombing civilian infrastructure is considered a war crime under international law. How does an entire country have its internet connection blown up using US-made weapons, and yet the media says absolutely nothing? How is this not a front-page news story? All the media do is talk about Iran-backed Houthi rebels as if people in Yemen are too stupid to govern themselves or exercise self-determination. Like, all the decisions in Yemen must come from Iran. And the same thing in Iraq, right? If you're sick of Americans occupying your land and you resist, which is your right under international law, then you must be Iran-backed. Why don't they call the Saudi-led coalition US-backed? The United States have given far more support, literally hundreds of billions of dollars worth of weapons to the Saudis and their friends. More support than Iran has ever given to the Yemenis. Do you know what the reaction to this deadly strike was? U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken posted on Twitter that he had spoken with Saudi Arabia's Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan to, quote, reiterate our commitment to bolster the defense capabilities of Saudi Arabia and Gulf partners while mitigating civilian harm. Apparently, Blinken's idea of mitigating civilian harm is selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, which are used to kill Yemeni civilians. Perhaps Blinken's idea of bolstering Saudi Arabia's defense capabilities means blowing up detention centers, killing prisoners, and taking Yemen's internet offline. Oh yeah, that sounds very defensive indeed. Again, Blinken tweeted this just a few hours after Saudi Arabia's airstrikes. The timing is not an accident. It's very clear. He knows perfectly well what Saudi Arabia just did, what Saudi Arabia has been doing for years. And instead of condemning this massacre, never mind cutting off arms sales, he doubles down and says that the United States will keep on giving the Saudis weapons so they can defend themselves. Defend themselves from what? Civilians? Prisoners in their cells? Yemen's internet connection? When Yemen carried out its strike on Abu Dhabi, the West condemned it immediately. The State Department put out a statement saying it condemns these terrorist attacks. Blinken tweeted his condolences to the victims. But when Saudi Arabia takes out vital civilian infrastructure and kills dozens more people, like it has been for years, it's crickets. All of a sudden, they don't know how to condemn violent, heinous acts anymore, because they don't want to upset their little friend Saudi Arabia. All these hypocrites who dress up in their nice suits, complete silence. right? All these people in their suits who pretend to care about human rights. Crickets. Jen Psaki, the White House spokesperson, was asked if the Biden administration would condemn the attack by Saudi Arabia, just like they were quick to condemn the Yemeni attack on Abu Dhabi. As you can imagine, as expected, there was no condemnation, just a spineless, rubbish answer.
What's the administration's immediate reaction to this strike? And does this prompt any reconsideration of weapon sales to Saudi Arabia?
I don't have any prediction of that at this point in time. Obviously, we have a long history of a relationship with Saudi Arabia, one where we raise issues where we have significant concerns on human rights and on a range of issues, and one where we have had a long security relationship that has been in the interest of the United States. In terms of this specific strike and a reaction, obviously, any time there's a loss of life, of innocent lives, that is a tragedy, and we are mindful of that and focused on that.
After the strike on Abu Dhabi, after Yemen was defending itself, U.S. President Joe Biden had the gall to say that he was considering redesignating the Yemen Salvation Government a foreign terrorist organization.
That you declared when you came to office was to end the war in Yemen, the catastrophic war in Yemen. You appointed a special envoy. Today, one of your allies, United Arab Emirates, is asking your administration to put back the Houthi rebels or militias back on the terror list. Are you going to do that? And how are you going to end the war in Yemen, sir?
The answer is it's under consideration, and ending the war in Yemen takes the two parties to be involved to do it, and it's going to be very difficult.
And this is what Donald Trump did right before he left office. Remember, he and then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who ran wild slapping people with sanctions as part of their maximum pressure campaign, they went and targeted Yemen. As a result, there was a real fear that an even bigger famine would ensue. People in Yemen are so undernourished as a result of the Saudi coalition's bombings and blockade. Most of the food in Yemen is imported through traders, and by sanctioning Yemen, this effectively means that no one would want to do business anymore for fear of U.S. reprisal, and that food would stop flowing in. According to the United Nations, Yemen is going through the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Food and medical supplies are low, compounding these tragedies and making it even harder to recover and to help those who are wounded by these strikes. Now, Joe Biden did reverse this designation after taking office, but for how long, if he's considering slapping on the terrorist label again? Biden also claimed that he will be ending the war in Yemen.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
Obviously, that was a lie. Look at the massacres that just took place. The U.S. is still giving Saudi Arabia weapons. It just calls them defensive weapons now, as if that makes a difference. They're still killing Yemenis in the end, and the arms dealers are still making money. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Now, joining me to further discuss the situation in Yemen is Yasser Al-Muhallil. He is a Yemeni journalist currently based in Damascus. And Yasser, first of all, thank you for coming on the program. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for hosting.
Could I just get your immediate reaction to what's happening in Yemen, these Saudi strikes, a wave of Saudi strikes the entire week? What is your initial reaction?
Yes. As you know, in the recent days, United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia just tried to intensify their operations on the ground. So they tried to take over several areas in Shabwa district, which is in the south of Yemen. And as you know that, hitting United Arab Emirates by our drones and plastic missiles stopped for like 2 or 2.5 years because UAE just showed that they are a little bit out of the conflict in Yemen. I know it was like a deceiving reaction that they are trying to put for the international community and trying to put for Yemenis so they don't get hit by our drones of plastic missiles. But now, after they get back to the ground with the intense, with a very, very, very hard operation on the ground, they took over, as I told you, they took over some areas in the in Shabwa district, and they are trying to just go back to the to their tight alliance with Saudi Arabia, invading our countries and killing our people. So this had to be faced with a reaction from Sana'a, which was making our just committing an operation towards Abu Dhabi and hitting some very important facilities in there. Yeah, this is the reason why. You know, if you just separate a little bit between Saudi Arabia and the UAE, we are in the middle of, you know, firing paddle with Saudi Arabia. It didn't stop for the seven continuous years, but UAE had to go back for this paddle for their own reasons. I think the Israeli and the American are putting pressure on UAE to go back to the paddle because Saudi Arabia now is facing a very hard situation in Yemen alone. That's why they brought the troops back to Yemen and fought again in Yemen. And of course, like Saudi Arabia are being hit every single day, maybe because of the continuous air raids and continuous crimes against the people of Yemen. So United Arab Emirates are going to face the same problem from Yemen, of course.
Yeah, and when we talk about the Emirates and Abu Dhabi facing a reaction, just recently there was a strike all the way in Abu Dhabi by Yemeni forces. What kind of message do you think that sends to the Emiratis? What kind of impact do you think it has on their morale and on how they're acting now on the battlefield?
Well, you know, as United Arab Emirates are weaker to face such reaction or to face such operations against its own security and economic facilities. You know, because Saudi Arabia is maybe geographically is a bigger country, they can somehow stand for several operations and just take more and more operations inside or deep inside the country of Saudi Arabia. But United Arab Emirates cannot maybe take more or three such operations inside Abu Dhabi or Dubai, for example, you know, because if this really happens, the insecurity situation will just wipe away all the investors out of the country, and it will be a very bad situation for United Arab Emirates. And I think why United Arab Emirates are trying now to put the blame on Yemen or Sana'a for the intensifying operation. I mean, the backlash it's just, you know, it's our right to defend our country. It's not like we want war. It's like that we are seeking for more wars. We are, the Yemeni people are being more, the one who are being killed, the one who are being sick, are being prevented from their essential needs. They are not, you know, able to have even a fuel right now. Hospitals are being, you know, a shortage of fuel. They're being blocked. Besides that, they're being targeted, the hospitals and all the infrastructures in Yemen. But I think if United Arab Emirates continues these continuous crimes, recent crimes like what happened yesterday in Sana'a, what happened in Hodeidah and other and so many countries and so many, I mean, districts inside the country, they will face even more operations inside their country, and the Yemeni military will just, you know, carry out more operations into Abu Dhabi or into Dubai or any place they choose to just, you know, to make or to put some pounds in this path.
Do you think that these strikes from this week by the Saudis are sort of, a form of revenge for the strike on Abu Dhabi?
Well, I think it's an Emirati airstrikes in the first place, not only Saudi airstrikes nowadays. I mean, in the recent 3 days after the operation took place in Abu Dhabi, because, you know, as long as they have a green light from the international community and they have the green light from the United States of America, which is covering all the crimes in the United Nations or in the United Nations Security Council, as you know, while the people of Yemen are getting targeted and over 70 persons were killed in one single day, the United Nations Security Council condemned our right to defend ourselves. They did not condemn these crimes against humanity in Yemen. And this is right. The double standard that the international community is trying to put in the whole picture of what's going on in Yemen. So what I really think is that Saudi Arabia and UAE are not going to reach anything with their intensifying crimes against the people of Yemen. They will just put more reasons to be hit back into their own country, into their own cities, and into their own security and economic stability that they are always paying for.
Yeah, I mean, there's one thing that comes to mind. There was a Saudi ship that was seized by Yemeni forces, which the Saudis claimed was carrying medical supplies. Was it really medical supplies or something else?
Well, that was so funny, you know, just declaring that it's carrying some like medical supplies, you know. Footage that have been disclosed by the military of Yemen showed that this ship was carrying weapons, was carrying like vehicles, military vehicles, armored vehicles. That it was carrying also a radar machines, a very hard war machines. They were not like medical supplies, like they say, because and even the international community could not accept this justifications from the Saudi Arabia, because they saw the pictures and they saw the footage, and they also called for immediate cessation of the ship, but they did not say whether it's really carrying like medical supplements for what they called is a hospital. It's not right. And if it was right, of course, they don't even have the right to go across within the water of, within the sovereignty of Yemeni water. They got close to the water that had been taken over from the Yemeni authorities, and this is not acceptable. If they really want to, just provide some like medical supplements to their affiliates or to their troops.
When you mentioned the port of Hodeida, this terrible bombing, we have a prison being bombed, at least 70 people being killed, and also the telecommunications. All of Yemen has had its internet cut off. Can you tell us how the situation is? Are other Yemenis able to speak with their families? Do you have any means of finding out what's actually happening on the ground?
Well, you know, I was trying to reach out to my family since like 18 hours from now. It's very hard now to reach the family, even trying to call them by phones, by cell phones, not able for now because of the airstrike that targeted all the telecom companies' facility in Hodeida, and it's the main gate that provides internet access to everywhere in Yemen. So now it's a whole block out of internet access in the country. We don't know whether our families are safe or not, because the airstrikes continues in the country. We really don't know what's the situation in Yemen. We can't reach out to our families, our mothers, our siblings, and the situation for me is the same for hundreds of thousands of people outside the country. They cannot reach millions in Yemen to see how they are doing while the bombing is still taking place intensively in the country, all over the country, from Sada to Sana'a to Hodeida to everywhere, every village, every city, every neighborhood is being targeted by Saudi Arabia airstrike right now. But I hope that our families are safe and they And I wish we can reach out to them very soon if it gets fixed, you know, the internet connection to Yemen. And this really is added to the war crimes that have been committed inside my country. Saudi Arabia knows that they are targeting an infrastructure and facility of telecommunication. They want the internet to be cut off, so they cannot be the crimes cannot be covered to the whole world, and the whole cannot see what's going on in Yemen. And that's the main reason. And I think they will not be able to hide their crimes for a long time, because everyone in the world now is talking about how criminal they are and how crimes in Yemen are so brutal.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope you're able to reach your family soon and everyone else, and that this bloody war comes to an end. So these Western countries make exorbitant amounts of money from selling weaponry, which they know is used to make the world's worst humanitarian crisis even worse, but then they go ahead and do it anyway. It's so obvious that the term human rights is an arbitrary term that's cynically used by the West. They don't care about the human rights of the Yemenis that they kill, or the Syrians, the Venezuelans, the Iranians, the Cubans that they've killed. If you don't bend the knee to Western interests, if you want to be independent and free from neocolonialism, then you have no human rights. Now, obviously, the strike on Abu Dhabi didn't cause any major damage to the Emiratis or completely cripple their war effort, but it did send a very potent message, and it did open a new front in the war. The Yemenis have shown that they are able to strike deep within enemy territory, all the way from home, thousands of kilometers away. It is a game changer, whether people realize it or not. And it shows that the tide of the war is turning. Yemen has become a quagmire for the Saudis and their coalition. This is a fight that they cannot win. This war has been going on for 7 years. If the Yemenis didn't already surrender in the face of such adversity, after so much famine, so much suffering, then they're certainly not going to surrender now. Despite all their efforts, the axis of resistance, of which Yemen is an integral, essential part, is in fact stronger today than ever before. And neither Saudi Arabia nor the Emirates can crush it, no matter how many American and British bombs they buy. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In its propaganda portraying itself as a champion of human rights, the EU has declared that wherever they may be in the world, a child is a child first and foremost. But it appears that when it comes to Palestinian children, only exceptional cases like those of Amal Nakhle merit EU sympathy. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Tamara Nassar, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "For EU, a child is a child, except when Palestinian." Stay tuned for more. There are growing calls on the Zionist regime to immediately release a medically vulnerable Palestinian teen who has been imprisoned for more than a year without charge or trial. Amal Nakhle was 17, a child, when the Zionist regime authorities arrested him in January 2021. He lives with a rare chronic autoimmune disease. He recently tested positive for the coronavirus, which heightens the concern about his well-being because his condition places him at increased risk of serious illness. Following the positive coronavirus test, the Zionist regime transferred Nakhle to the Ramal prison clinic, which is nicknamed the Slaughterhouse by detained Palestinians. Since his arrest, the Zionist regime military has held Nakhle in administrative detention, which can be renewed indefinitely. Under the most recent renewal earlier this month, Nakhle will be detained until at least 18th of May. Like all other administrative detainees, Nakhle is held based on secret evidence that the Zionist regime military authorities refused to show to him or his lawyers. Several UN agencies are urging Nakhle's immediate and unconditional release. Amal's case is one of the more prolonged cases where a Palestinian child has been detained without charge or trial, said the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights in a joint appeal with Children's Agency UNICEF and Palestine Refugee Agency UNRWA. It is, however, not an isolated case. Currently, at least another three Palestinians are in administrative detention who were under the age of 18 when first detained, the UN agencies added. In December, the UN Human Rights Council's Working Group on Arbitrary Detention issued an opinion on Nakhle's case, concluding that the Zionist regime should release him immediately. Uncharacteristically, the European Union also called on the Zionist regime to release Nakhle, as did the Irish diplomatic mission in the occupied West Bank. The EU mission in the West Bank said recently that Nakhle must be released immediately. EU representatives rarely intervene on behalf of Palestinian prisoners held by the Zionist regime. When they do comment, it is usually in the advanced stages of a hunger strike. Even then, the EU does not demand their release. At most, the EU calls for the detainee to be charged and receive a fair trial. But there is no such thing as a fair trial for Palestinians subjected to the Zionist regime military occupation. Palestinians from the West Bank are subject to the Zionist regime's military tribunals, which have a near 100% conviction rate. A feature of the Zionist regime system of apartheid is that Jewish settlers living in the West Bank are not subject to the military tribunals, but to the Zionist regime civilian courts. Previously, the EU urged that the Zionist regime hold the extensive use of administrative detention, implying the practice may be used, if more sparingly. But most commonly, the EU expresses varying levels of concern. In short, in the rare cases when the EU is not silent about the thousands of Palestinian political prisoners, including children, held by the Zionist regime, its statements are muted and late. Of course, Amal Nakhle must be released immediately and unconditionally, as should all Palestinian children and political detainees held by the Zionist regime. The Zionist regime is holding 160 other Palestinian children, and 500 Palestinians are currently imprisoned without charge or trial. The Zionist regime is the only regime in the world that routinely subjects children, and only Palestinian children, to military tribunals. But it is notable that the EU is only willing to demand the immediate and unconditional release of Nakhle. Could it be that EU officials are willing to do so only because he can be portrayed as sufficiently deserving of their sympathy due to his medical condition? In its propaganda portraying itself as a champion of human rights, the EU has declared that, wherever they may be in the world, a child is a child first and foremost. Every child's rights must be, therefore, fully and equally protected. But it appears that, when it comes to Palestinian children, only exceptional cases like those of Amal Nakhle, merit EU sympathy. Nakhle and the hundreds of other Palestinians arbitrarily imprisoned by the occupier are currently boycotting the Zionist regime's military courts. The protest was launched on the first day of the year as an act of collective resistance to a system Israeli human rights group B'Tselem describes as a Kafkaesque legal reality.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we saw how herbicides used by the Australian government decimated its employees and left children and partners critically ill. Assured by the government that it was safe, it was common for Australian workers in the 60s and 70s to use toxic herbicides without using proper protective clothing. Since then, a terrifyingly high number of these former government employees have died or become seriously ill, almost certainly as a result of their constant exposure to dioxin, a deadly chemical impurity found in herbicide 2,4,5-T. Of course, 2,4,5-T has now been banned, but stay with us as we investigate how a lack of regulation and testing of cheap imports means potentially deadly levels of the dioxin may still be present in weed control products today.
You'll clear that and left me.
Yep.
Molly Dunn believes she knows more than most in Yarram about the toxic aftermath of spraying 2,4,5-T and 2,4-D. She had a stillborn baby 5 months into a pregnancy. At the time, her husband Percy Dunn was a sprayer for the Victorian Lands Department at Yarram.
They didn't actually have protective clothing back then. No clothes, no masks, no nothing much, you know.
Percy Dunn died of cancer in 1980. The 60-year-old had been ill for many years after spraying the herbicides in paddocks and along creeks to kill blackberries and ragwort weed infestations. 2 years after he died, Molly took the Victorian government to court and was awarded $17,500 in workers' compensation. But no liability was admitted. All these years later, she's still grieving his death. Percy Dunn's family is believed to be the only one in Yarram to have received government compensation.
Do you think it's wrong that families like yours only get compensation when they're prepared to go to court?
Yeah, well, that's the government, isn't it? They don't want to pay out anything unless they have to.
And there'd be surpluses in those drums too.
It's very similar to the asbestos cases that I've been involved in. The denial is put forward and the worker's got a battle to prove beyond reasonable doubt. And it's very hard to do in chemical cases.
In Yarram, many of the sprayers have died.
Very short breath, though.
Yeah, well, me too.
Tony Cassidy and Pat Reed are the lucky ones, sick but still alive.
Anyway, he's looking at you, Doc.
Righto.
I've got cancer of the bladder. In fact, I've got to go tomorrow for more exploratory surgery.
How many of your mates that you used to spray with have been sick or have died?
Oh, well, all of them are sick. Some are probably not as sick as me, but they're all sick. And I'd say probably 75% of them have died.
Any breeze where you've got it all over you. You're wet through some bloody days.
What, just covered in stuff?
Yeah.
Sprayer Pat Reed thinks he was unwittingly dragged into a cover-up when he was told by his boss to bury about 80 of the drums on Crown land just outside of Yarram.
Tree over there, the clean one.
Oh, right, okay.
About there.
About there?
Yeah.
Pat took us to the site of where he buried them more than 30 years ago.
They put the axe through them up on the truck
and threw them into the hole, and I crunched them up with a dozer and then filled it all in.
Nothing there?
We knew there was something going on. Digging a hole out to put drums in, so something funny.
Out in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah.
Why do you think the Lands Department asked the men to bury the drums?
Drums there?
Because the heat was on. Get rid of them. We don't want them on the premises because people were starting to snip around and ask questions.
It should never have been used for manual spraying or aerial spraying. It was a poison that you couldn't contain.
It wasn't until the 1990s that 245T, which was thought to be more toxic than 24D, was banned by all states in Australia. This was some years after the United States took it off its market. What made 245T so toxic was the heating of the reaction mixture during manufacture, which created dangerous dioxins.
You can not ensure that dioxins are not being formed even if you employ the best production processes. I think this is one of the reasons why 245T was banned, because what you require is an additional step, which is a purification step, and that is relatively costly.
Kills the entire weed, roots and all.
What many people don't realise is that the second chemical in Agent Orange, 24D, which was developed in the 1940s, is still widely used.
A plane dusts a field of young wheat with 24D.
24D is a cheap and effective weed killer.
The destruction of many weeds is complete.
There are more than 200 24D products registered in Australia.
It's used in many agricultural applications. It's used in pastures and cropland for broadleaf control. It's also used in areas that people probably wouldn't expect, such as turf spraying for sporting fields, for councils in their cosmetic applications, for verges and those sorts of things.
Many of the major chemical companies are represented by a peak body, CropLife Australia.
Weeds are a massive cost. If you had to manage them in other ways, we're talking, you know, just for a normal farm, thousands of work hours.
Hey there.
Hi.
So this is a sample.
Right.
It's generally assumed that there's no dangerous dioxins in 24D due to today's improved manufacturing standards. But 3 years ago, a team of Queensland scientists set out to prove there were no dioxins in pesticides and were amazed at what they discovered.
We actually didn't believe the results. We said there must have been a cross-contamination because these levels are not possible anymore today. They were, for some of the pesticides, similar to what was known from 245T, which was banned in the 80s, 90s.
Associate Professor Carolyn Gale sent her researchers back to the laboratory to repeat the tests. And when they returned positive, she expanded the study to include other pesticides, including 24D. Tests on one 24D product came back showing moderate levels of dioxins. This product was made by a Brisbane company, but it may have had its active ingredient imported. There's no way of knowing, as the regulator classifies this as commercial in confidence. Many Australian companies today import their active ingredients from countries like China and India.
What that really means is that it depends on the manufacturer, as well as the year of manufacture, as well as the batch or the country of manufacture, on how much dioxin you actually produce or have left as an impurity in the 24D formulation.
We've been told many, many times over the years that industry has cleaned up its act, that they have new processing equipment, new techniques, new technology that will eliminate dioxin from their herbicides and therefore from our environment. But I think the latest studies that are showing these contaminant levels indicate that that's not the case, that industry hasn't come clean about the nature of the contaminants of dioxin in 2,4-D, and the government really needs to take a close look at this.
Despite the low to moderate levels found in 2,4-D, its widespread use rang alarm bells.
So if you have a moderate toxicity but you use very high volumes, then the risk could be the same as having very high toxicity but very low volume of use.
2,4-D was tested, and the level of dioxins that were found were lower than elsewhere in the world. So that gave us some comfort.
That gave you some comfort?
Some comfort.
That they found moderate levels of dioxin in 2,4-D?
That it was low to moderate.
The regulator, the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, decided to see for itself if dioxins were present. It repeated the Queensland tests.
The APVMA came in and also tested for dioxins in a range of chemicals, and we worked with the health department as well in assessing the outcomes of that. And
when you tested, did you find dioxins as well?
I understand that when the testing was done, we did find some levels of dioxins, and that's when it's been referred to the health department.
Did you find it in 2,4-D?
I would have to... I don't know the answer to that question.
Exposure to dioxin is consistent with this pattern of adverse health effects, and I think that there are solid scientific reasons to be concerned about dioxin exposures following 2,4-D use.
Four Corners decided to test for dioxin contamination in one of the many imported products. We purchased 2,4-D weed killer from this warehouse in Sunshine just outside of Melbourne and sent it to government laboratories for testing. The 2,4-D weed killer, Aminos 625, was imported from China by an Australian company, Senonda, based in an office in Melbourne. We purchased the 2,4-D weed killer, which is often sold direct to farmers, no questions asked. It's almost 3 weeks on, and we've just received our results from the government laboratory. Alarmingly, our sample of 2,4-D weed killer came back with dioxin levels almost seven times higher than those found by the Queensland scientists. And what's even more disturbing is we don't know how many contaminated 2,4-D products are out there in the community because authorities are not routinely testing. Four Corners gave the results to Associate Professor Carolyn Gauss to analyse.
I was actually surprised because you only analysed one formulation and actually returned such a high result. I thought it was unlikely today, but again, that is a reality check when we think back to our previous study where we actually didn't expect any contamination in the pesticides. It just demonstrates again that what we're seeing today is equally or even worse than 10 to 20 years ago, and that is of concern, of course.
Each year, more than $100 million worth of 2,4-D products are sold in Australia, and we don't know which ones contain imported ingredients.
We have seen a new scenario develop in Australia with high Australian dollar, massive production increase in places like China, and fairly free trade between the two countries, that a large amount of product is now coming in. The country of origin, as I suggested, doesn't automatically imply good or bad. What we do need to ensure is that we deal with reliable suppliers.
But it's not just about having a reliable supplier. Scientists say we should be monitoring for dioxins in all pesticides. And that's the job of the regulator.
Without monitoring each of the batches or regular monitoring, we pretty much don't have any chance to really realise what is being on the market and how much of the dioxin is being released with pesticide use. The APVMA hasn't found any evidence of high levels of dioxin in imported chemicals.
Are you testing for it?
The APVMA doesn't do independent testing. However, it is concerns about potential quality of imported goods is often referred to us from many different sources.
But how do you know if they've got dangerous dioxins in them?
If there were high levels of dioxins, it would affect the final chemical, and we would expect to see in the public use concerns about the efficacy or the chemical itself, and we're not seeing that.
Who should test for dioxin in these imports, the companies or the regulator?
Well, I would suggest that any regulatory system should have an independent testing regime to it.
We also don't know how much 2,4-D is being sprayed around Australia.
The lack of volume data makes it really hard to make any kind of sensible risk management decisions. If you've got a chemical where there's an identified problem and you don't know how much is being used or where it's used or in what circumstances it's being used, it's very difficult to develop sensible regulatory